Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. One question that every investor grapples with at some point is how to invest their next dollar. Generally, there's heaps of information out there about how to establish a portfolio, and your early decisions about asset allocation are probably very well researched and very well considered. But as time goes on and your portfolio grows, each new inflow of money can often be more challenging to allocate. Today, to discuss this problem and some thoughts on how to tackle it in today's environment, I'm talking to resident fixed income guru and NAB's head of client engagement for markets, Mark Todd. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. How are you doing?
I've been here before. Yep. Mark, we're making a bit of an assumption here when we get started that people's portfolios were established very intentionally, that you know, they started a self-managed super fund and rolled in a big lump of cash and had to allocate it, or they've built up their portfolio over time with savings, and each time they're invested, they've been allocated very carefully to those investments where there was the greatest potential, matching risk profile and all that stuff. Is that your experience of how most people invest?
I would offer the thought that would mean the herd had died.
Okay.
Because throughout life, it's always, often, not always, often, it's the herd mentality impacts the way people invest. I don't know that you have two different types of investors, I presume. There's the professional investor who is paid to take reasoned decisions, and then there is a non-professional investor who is given information in a broad array of contexts. Over a coffee, this is really good, this is an interesting story, reads it in a paper, online, you know, there's different chat rooms. And then they sit down and say, well, I think all the economy is doing well, so who represents the economy? It's the banks. It'll be Telstra, it'll be Wesfarmers, Coles, that sort of stuff, and then they'll buy on that basis. And of course, then there's the advice from the broking fraternity to say, look, you should do that. So it's hard to point to one way that they build it, but I would suggest that the vast percentage of people acquire it by default. I don't know. I don't think they spend the level of attention to that detail that we would like them to do it. And the reason for that, is that the basis that I think that's probably true is the GFC hurt so many people, and what we learnt that was so many people were in assets they didn't know anything about. And so the anger that's coming out of that via response to advisors, pressure on advisors to get it right, changing in the demands of the standards of advisors, the way the stockbrokers have seen a lowering of activity, you know, turnover is less. So I think people are tone deaf to that message in a lot of cases, not all the time. So I'd imagine there is an anger around portfolio construction inherent in a lot of portfolios where people are saying, I didn't really know why I was getting into that. I just got into it.
I think you make a really good point, actually, because certainly when we've done some focus groups and there are investors I talk to, a lot of them are holding higher levels of cash. We know self-managed super funds hold 25% of their portfolio in cash and TDs. A lot of individuals are holding really defensive assets. But, and as much as they loathe the low interest rates, they feel secure because they understand them. And so they feel that, that defensive position is worth taking. The question I asked originally was partly because some of the wealthier people I know end up having a bit of everything, because each new cash investment they make, every time they get an extra bit of money, they allocate it to a new opportunity. And the example that I've always remembered, because it shocked me when I first heard it, was a very, very wealthy guy who had many millions of dollars invested. This was quite some time ago. And when I asked about his structure and strategy, he said, to be honest, I should just sell a lot and put it in an index fund because I have at least a bit of every share in Australia. You know, he had bought every new thing when it came to market. He'd bought everything that he didn't have. And so he had these allocations all over the place that were sort of somewhat unintentional.
But an index fund doesn't give him the fund that he probably had. And you started with the statement that he's really affluent. He's really well off.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not a rounding error at all. You know, if you get it right, you can make lots of money, but how much is enough? And he's probably of the view that I like people coming and pitching ideas to me, and I act on those ideas, and I feel I've got control of my own destiny. And that's probably the reason why it drives a lot of behaviour for a lot of investors, where they feel they have control of their own destiny. And that's the same with those who are in cash. They have control of their own destiny and they don't want to take the risk because they don't trust. And I think part of the challenge is creating an environment where the people who are receiving the commentary understand the natural bias of the commentator. So I have bias because I live. I have experiences. So I think, okay, I'm biased. Just, that's normal. I think the people who receive listen to the podcast, you think, okay, what's the intention of the person? Like, are they trying to just help? Or are they trying to flog me something? And I think you need to be very mindful of that as people write it. And there's a lot of smart writers who ultimately, whether they meant it or not, just think, just give me your money and I'll look after it.
One of the best articulations of that was, I was speaking to Meg Heffron of Heffron SMSF Services. So they provide an administration service for self-managed super funds. And I said, you know, how do you feel about people criticising SMSFs? And she said, well, I'm biased. She said, I manage SMSF money, right? That's what I do. I provide administration services for that. So I am always going to be defensive of SMSFs. I know that they're not right for everybody, but that doesn't mean that I think they're wrong.
But isn't the great conundrum in the world right now, or certainly in Australia, is the lack of intent around people investing? So you have a superannuation fund via work, whatever way form you have, and you have no idea whatsoever about what's happening with your money. And you have no feel-good sense of that. If you are with an industry super fund and it's doing really well, you don't have that, great, look at this, this is really fantastic. You don't walk home and buy yourself an extra lollipop because you've had a really good week. You don't do that. And because you're probably, A, not aware of it, even though all the industry super funds, all the retail super funds are doing their level best to make you aware of it, we as a nation don't think that way around our investments. We aren't aligned to that. We're aligned to things like property. Feel good in property. That I've got my house, I've got my apartment, I've got my piece of land, and I'm paying it off and I feel good about that. My industry super fund is returning 10% per annum and I will retire an affluent person. Really? I didn't know that. And so that's part of the great conundrum around educating people and saying you really should either have an SMSF or be aware of what your industry fund or your retail fund or whoever is looking after your money is doing with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the crusade I'm on.
Well, if nothing else, you should have intentionally chosen that fund or at the very minimum done your research to be sure that you're happy with the fund that you were defaulted into. So what is the number one question you're getting from investors when they are thinking about this next dollar to invest? What are they thinking?
Everything feels fully valued, and the discrepancy between yield-based assets, so fixed income, floating rate returns, and equity markets and the property market seems great. So the property market seems soft. Can I go into that? Should I buy that? They're very unsure of that one. The yield markets, whether it be in term deposits or other rates and credit, seem low, are low, and therefore how can I live off that? And then equity markets, that's just a tweet away from a 2% sell-off. So what do I do there? And I think it's all a story of relative value and a story of strategy. And I ask people to just, you know, ponder the strategy as it relates to them, because it's very hard to offer specific advice. I don't think your intent is to try and mislay your advice. You know, you don't want to put it into the wrong pigeonhole and say everyone should do the following, and then somebody does it and says, hang on, that didn't work for me. So you need to have a strategy, and I tell everyone, okay, what is your goal of this extra dollar? So what risk do you want to take? And then trying to think about it, if you lost that dollar, how would you feel? What would that mean to your lifestyle? And therefore, do the probability. What's the likelihood of losing 100% of this or 25% of this? the equity market to drop 25% would be a significant change. So I'm asking people to look at things like the equity market and use option protection. You can get very bespoke option pricing now. And if you said, I want to buy $100 worth of something, you could get protection for 95% downside. So in other words, it loses 5%, you have no risk, or 10%. So the less you lose, the higher the costs. The drivers of those costs are interest rates continue to be low, volatility continue to be low. So you should go to your broker, or you can go to people at the NAB. It might be a little bit harder in the NAB to find them, but they do offer that service at the NAB. The way to think about this is, if you want to hand over risk, big organisations like the NAB will take risk. They look to price that risk. So think about it that way. So call NAB Trade, and they'll put you in touch with somebody, or you can call, you know, the people in, you know, email me directly. But if you price that risk and say, okay, I want to protect myself on the downside by 5% or 10%, then you can put that new dollar to work in the equity market and say, okay, I've sort of a cheaper price protected myself. That's fine. You know, look at that.
Okay. So you've made some comments about the different assets to which people may allocate. Mm-hmm. Equity markets are a really interesting one. They were sold off heavily last year and then have come roaring back. We've looked at some of the sectors as well that have really roared back. It's been quite fascinating to see how much risk people are happy to take in that part of the world. What I find really interesting, so one of NAB's senior economists recently moved to our New York office, and he likes to post updates about his New York experience and about his thoughts on the US. And it all boils down to exactly what you said, which is, even in the US, everyone's going, everything looks fully priced. Nothing looks cheap. There doesn't appear to be any value, in inverted commas, floating around. However, the economy is holding up, tariffs notwithstanding. That's a different issue entirely. Everything's holding up. So do I want to sit on the sidelines if things are going to keep trucking?
Well, okay, so I think I've given you a strategy on equities that I think seems sensible. Price it, work out if you want to use it, and buy the protection. I think in terms of credit, you can be very bespoke on credit. We've been mandated for NextDC. So a mandate notice on NextDC is a company that NAB is very familiar with. We've had a few different bond issues with those organisations, and or that organisation. And so NextDC will come to market. I think the way to think about that is, am I being compensated for the risk? So you can go, if you're a sophisticated investor, you can talk to the NAB about maybe being an investor in that one. The hybrid market continues to perform well. So I do think if you consider a balanced approach, you could say, what are the rules that I want to work on for credit? So I want to have 300 over. 300 over the prevailing cash rate. Is that enough? Make that decision. I want to buy equities. I want protection. For new money, that feels like the right strategy, where it's not really the fear of missing out. It's fear of losing your money.
Mm.
That's what people are feeling right now. And so therefore, they're two strategies that you think, okay, in credit, am I compensated for the risk? So in fixed income and floating rate notes, hybrids, am I compensated for the risk? New issues, so new issue premium, am I getting the right number for that? And then the equity market, you know, play it from the safe side.
What are your thoughts? So one issue that has been bandied around for a while, so Australian investors are generally heavily overweight financials. So they've got a lot of their equity portfolio in banks, effectively. And if we look at the NAB trade base, it's around 35%. It's not small. When we did some analysis last year, the top 10 stocks on NAB trade were over 50% of the book. So people were very concentrated in the top 10, and the top 10 had five financials in it. Actually six, Macquarie was number 10. So very, very deeply invested into banks. Australians are also heavily overweight property, and the turn in the property cycle, certainly in the big states, which is where the weight of money is, let's say, and property is most expensive on a residential basis anyway, has been acute, more acute than some people were expecting. What are your thoughts on people looking at that and going, I'm overweight property? If I'm also overweight financials in my equity portfolio, I have a lot of exposure to the property market. Should I be thinking about minimizing some of that exposure and diversifying into other sectors or into other types of assets? Do you think there's a correlation risk there?
There's definitely a correlation risk between the property market and the financials. And the financials will dominate because of the size of the financials as they relate to the size of their position in the economy. You know, it's what they are. I completely understand that correlation. What do you do about it? Right now, if you think we go to a lower interest rate environment, there's some pressure expectations on lower rates here, it makes it hard to work out where to invest money. I think they'd be looking to support the property market via lower rates, so that sort of seems to make some sense. If you define for yourself what the macro drivers are to impact your portfolio, okay, I can tell you that it will be unemployment levels.
Mm-hmm.
So look for unemployment levels as it relates to your portfolio. Look at the performance of the economy. If the economy seems to be moving forward, even if it's just, you know, benignly sideways, and look at inflation. If you look at those three, which will come out every quarter, and you start to see anything move in that, then you can make a decision on selling or doing whatever you like. If that's not good enough, if that's not good enough protection, go and buy 1 year out of the money puts on the four majors at a 10% discount, and then you are hedged. So you just go and buy those, they'll be cheap. Go and buy that and say, look, I want to invest, you know, $50,000 to hedge up my portfolio and sleep well. Work on your yoga.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. I think also it's worth noting, you know, if we're talking about investing your next dollar, if you know that you're heavily overweight financials or anything else for that matter, if you're heavily overweight resources or you're heavily overweight property or whatever you may happen to be heavily overweight and you're concerned about risks in that sector, you can purchase some downside protection, as you say, which is excellent. But you can also consider that every additional dollar you get just will not be allocated to that, or you will only allocate to things that are inversely correlated or uncorrelated, to whatever extent you can determine that. And if that's what you're trying to do, you won't change your absolute risk. Like in dollar terms, your risk is still the same, but your proportionate risk is quite different. You've got another part of your portfolio is going to hold up if that thesis does play out.
Sure. So I think you've got to actually find a growth asset.
Yep.
So that's the key to this. So if you're going to do any work whatsoever, working out whether the banks will go up or down in value, you know, I'm saying if you're worried about that, go buy protection, that's fine. Spend more time on working out whether the really big, you know, various tech businesses, various, you know, Uber et al., the disruptors or whatever, are going to work. Go and find that thing. Go and do proper due diligence on that. Go and use the product. Go and whatever it might be. Intimately understand Afterpay. Intimately understand whatever it might be that's the latest thing, and then that's your growth asset. And so therefore your risk in the portfolio is changed. If you get it right and it goes up by 10 or 15 or 20% because it's the right thing, the right disruptor, well, okay, you have leverage in your portfolio. You put down a dollar into that, having got $99 into a more conservative piece that's hedged. Find the right one. Don't do as you're at the start of the story, you know, buy everything, but actually get to understand something. Now, if you can't find that one, then don't do it. But spend some time learning about that stuff. Now, remember, I have said people are conflicted, so they'll try and flog you something. So don't buy whatever they flog you. Use the products and go, you know what, this is really pretty good. This is a disruptor that I really like and will use more of. I think that's the way to try and come to some conclusions around how you want to become an investor. I mean, that's definitely the story of Warren Buffett and the great story about American Express, where he just stood outside a line and watched everyone use it when it was in the midst of a crisis. And he said it didn't change the customer behavior. It's an existential crisis that other the market felt. So go about that way. The other thing I talk about is this idea about an intolerant economy. So an intolerant economy is, I don't want to wait, I want it now.
Hmm.
If I get in a queue, it has to be a good experience. So I can use my app and I can sign on into the train, plane, automobile, my seat. I can do whatever I want. The intolerant economy is what the consumer is driven by. We want it. We want it right now. There is an intolerant economy for the investor. So if you make a miss, the market, the herd, really hurts you. They're the ones you should look at, because the herd is hurting it because of it's intolerant. But is the fundamentals, are the fundamentals wrong? So spend some time on those things. So find a growth asset, look at things that have been sold off heavily and understand why were they sold off. Is it just because the herd's after it, and can you get to know more about it? And they're probably your two strategies for new money about growth.
We talked recently about the inverted yield curve, which is a well-regarded predictor of a future recession, sure. Bearing in mind that it is by no means 100% reliable. Anything changed on that front that would be meaningful for people who do have dollars to invest?
It's very clear that central banks are not going to lift rates anytime soon.
Mm.
And big money will continue to go to that long end of the curve as a way of getting a return. One interesting sidebar, and you know, for all the people that would listen to this, I don't know everything.
Really?
Truly. But you know, you try the best you can. An interesting anecdote about all of this is that this real chase for yield is shaping some of the behaviour from the international investor. So if you're in Europe and you're in Japan, it looks and it feels right now that they are investing in the long end of the US curve and they are unhedged. Because if they hedge it, because of what's happening in the cross-currency, the different interest rates differentials, will mean that they will actually lose money if they buy those assets. So what they're doing, what it seems, you know, we're speaking generically, but what they seem to be doing is buying the US, staying long dollars, mm-hmm. and hoping the dollar will rally. So the value of the return on their asset is good, and then the rallying dollar is even better. So I think your inverted yield curve's thematic, will continue on because people are looking for an absolute return. And I think they're taking the currency risk right now. That seems to be what is happening in markets. So no change.
No change. Okay, that's good to know. Do you suggest then, you've talked about a number of different approaches people can use. So what you're looking for, are you looking for growth in your portfolio? Are you trying to be defensive? What is the objective of those next few dollars? Do you suggest that people have a fixed plan for each new dollar? If you think about superannuation, and you made the point about people who are in, you know, professionally managed funds. When you're in a professionally managed fund, the lovely thing is you don't have to make a decision. When your superannuation guarantee goes in every month or every quarter, then that decision's made for you. But if you have a self-managed super fund or you have any other investment dollars coming in regularly that you need to decide what to do with them, is it, in your experience, better to have a fixed plan and just execute on it, or to make each decision at the margin?
I think you've got to have a rule. A series of rules that you assess. And so you can do that on a Saturday morning over a coffee, or you can do it once a month, or you can do it every 6 months, whatever volatility you can take. But I think you have a series of rules. And right now, today, I would imagine your rules should be around a conservative approach with a view that when you feel you've got the no-brainer, then you put a small amount of money to the no-brainer. We've got Phil King from Regal is in the market at the moment with their LIC, and he talks about it in respect of just taking a single, because you know it's an easy single.
Hmm.
Think about it that way.
It's a cricket analogy, right? Yeah, for all people cricket. Listening who do not watch cricket, correct. The cricket analogy.
Yep, we've all heard of that though. It's so there is an idea that you say, I'm really conservative with every dollar I spend right now today in this environment because everything's so low.
Hmm.
And you say, that really is a no-brainer, that one, whatever that is. So NAB came out with a hybrid at 400 over. Okay, that was really well supported. That's a single. You look at it that way and say, I'm really comfortable with the risk I'm taking right now. And that's when you put some money to work in those things. But I think right now, today, it's confusing when you have a president tweeting because he's angry about something, and you see this really dramatic impact on different markets. And because of that intolerant economy, they can really hurt you. So volatility is really low unless you're on the wrong side of it. Now, mentally, you can see these things get intra-index could be really volatile. So the index is kind of steady, but the one you've got is really going lower. And you go, wow, that doesn't feel right. And you hear all these people should have just bought the index, and that doesn't really help you either. So I think it's take the singles at the moment.
Mark, this is going to continue to be a question for people, and it's always complex. In today's market, we get the same question over and over again. How do people keep up to date with your thoughts on this subject?
We've had some people email me and talk to me, so that's fine. Always great to hear from the customer. So it's mark.todd@nab.com.au. You can find me on NabTrade as often as you're allowing me on. We're doing a weekly update on the listed securities, so we'll have that on the fixed income piece on NabTrade as well. But a lot of the customers just reach out directly and say, what do you think? And if I can help, I'll help.
Mark, that's sensational. People very much love to talk to you directly, and they also love just to get some thoughts on some of these subjects because they're difficult to manage. Mark Todd from NAB Markets, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it's been helpful in your journey to creating wealth. We always love to hear from you also, so if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.